Welcome to New World Notes. This week's show is titled Libya and Iran, Same Old, Same Old. I am Kenneth Doust. I try to keep a sense of perspective. This is not easy when you've been hurled through the looking glass, stuffed down the rabbit hole, and forced to attend the mad tea party for years at a time. Sense of perspective. The world economy is in a tailspin. Poverty, hunger, and homelessness are skyrocketing. The people who live on Mother Earth are sick and dying from pollution and the effects of global warming. Government officials of every developed country are doing everything they can not to change the situation in the slightest, except to make it worse. The corporate media, as always, are vigorously defending established power. Now the United States is going to war with every third world country that possesses more than 6 quarts of oil, paid for by the increasingly unemployed, increasingly homeless American people. I saw a great poster the other day. It said, "Where are we going? And what am I doing in this handbasket?" Sense of perspective. Given all the above, how much outrage should one summon on being treated like nincompoops by the president and his administration? Okay, being treated like a nincompoop is same old, not change we can believe in. Then again, so is every policy of the Obama administration. Obama has outdone Bush in sending this country on a military rampage. We seem to be bombing, invading, and or running proxy wars in half the countries of Africa, and several in the Middle East. Now we add Uganda to the list. They tell us, "Don't worry, our troops are just military advisors." Wait, didn't I hear that before, somewhere or other? Where was it? Oh yes, Vietnam. I knew I'd heard that somewhere before. Nincompoopism has been a big factor in our war against Libya. Stories were told to justify our aggression there, stories that no sane adult could believe, and in fact have proved false. Like Gaddafi providing his troops with Viagra and ordering them to rape all the women. We'll get to Libya in a bit. But the low point of treating Americans as nincompoops has now been reached in the build-up to our near-future war against Iran. Now, nobody wants a war between the U.S. and Iran, except the Israeli government and the Zionist lobby in the U.S., plus a few hundred thousand wacko Christian extremists who think that the sooner God's forces exterminate all Islam, the sooner Christ will return. And maybe the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex. For them, that's just good business. So we'll have a war against Iran as soon as our citizens are prepared sufficiently to accept one. That's what they did with Iraq, and by the time we begin bombing Tehran, the Americans will have forgotten all about Baghdad, just as we've forgotten about Saigon, Port-au-Prince, Havana Harbor, and in 1989, what the heck was the capital of Grenada? I forget. Never mind. Now President Obama, Secretary of State Clinton, and Attorney General Holder are solemnly proclaiming that they foiled a dastardly Iranian plot to hire a Mexican drug cartel to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. in Washington, D.C. To arrange this assassination, the elite Quds unit of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards sent an American citizen, a failed used car dealer in Texas, to Mexico to arrange a hit, sending him $100,000 by wire transfer. A transfer that presumably the Iranians thought nobody would notice. Not even a successful used car dealer, a failed used car dealer. Also convicted of writing fraudulent checks. Did I mention that the ambassador was to be assassinated in a D.C. restaurant that in fact does not exist? Did I mention that, yet again, an FBI informant and a dim-witted patsy seem to have played the key roles in this supposed plot? Not only would no sane adult believe such a preposterous story, very few sane children would believe it either. No matter, It's good enough for the Obama administration to proclaim, and then threaten dire consequences to Iran in retaliation. Attention, all nincompoops! To arms! The Iranians are coming! But don't take my word for it. Here's commentator Glenn Ford.
Who said Barack Obama would bring sobriety and dignity to U.S. foreign policy? The president's men and top woman, Hillary Clinton, have thrown every stereotypical demon of Middle American nightmares into the psychological operations gumbo to create a war hysteria against Iran. No reflexive terror button is left unpushed, no racial hysteria unexploited. Bubble, bubble, boil, and trouble. The administration is cooking up an almost comically infernal witch's brew just in time for Halloween. What a confabulation. There's the Mexican drug cartel hitmen, the specter of a bomb exploding in a crowded upscale Washington eatery, plus attacks on Israelis, and of course, in the background, the elite Quds unit of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And if you believe the government story, well, that proves you are the typical American, and any idiot can keep you in a state of endless war. How convenient this alleged plot is to weave together the interests of the Mexican narco regime, which is at war with some of its drug billionaires and in league with others, and a permanent lackey of the United States. Saudi Arabia, the most reactionary regime on the planet, where one family demonstrates its fitness to control the world's largest oil reserves by building a skyscraper 3 times the height of the Empire State Building in the middle of a vast desert, and is also a collaborator with the United States in turning back the Arab Spring. And Israel, the uncontested champion violator of international law and United Nations resolutions, which maintains its supremacy in the Middle East and unique relationship to the United States by keeping the region permanently on the brink of Armageddon. All 4 players now claim Iran has all but declared war on virtually everybody by plotting to kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States. But the whole thing smells more like the FBI's schemes to frame black men in Miami and Newburgh, New York, for terroristic attacks that never did or could happen. Attorney General Eric Holder, the American entrapper-in-chief, says the Iranians wanted to pay $1.5 million to Mexican hitmen to kill the ambassador, possibly by blowing up a D.C. restaurant where lots of congresspersons also dined. But it turns out that a Drug Enforcement Administration confidential source in Mexico was the guy the Iranians supposedly contacted for the hit, and that he came up with the bombing idea, and that the restaurant doesn't even exist. A naturalized American who also kept his Iranian passport is now in custody. His alleged partner is an Iranian who has left the country and, if you believe the U.S. government, was connected somehow to the Iranian Quds force. We are supposed to believe that this is how the Iranians make war against the Western world. Mexico says the plot was a threat to its national security, although it's not alleged that even one Mexican hitman was actually contacted. Israel, well, the Israelis are always trying to get the U.S. to attack Iran, so there's nothing new there. And the Saudis are pretending to be the injured party, even though they years ago promised the use of their airspace to Israel and the United States for the purpose of bombing Iran. Iran calls the tale a children's story, which pretty much sums it up, except these American, Saudi, Mexican, and Israeli children are vicious, straight out of Lord of the Flies. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Glenn Ford, with his usual shrewd analysis. But wait, there's more. Middle Eastern political analyst Zafar Bangash has more facts about this preposterous cock-and-bull story. The previous Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar, is a powerful member of the Saudi royal family. The current Saudi ambassador is just a nobody, just a public servant with no following, no power back home. He's not even a member of the royal family. And for Iran to assassinate any official of a U.S. ally on U.S. soil would be a tremendous provocation, likely a catalyst for war. Nobody in Iran is crazy enough for that. If, for some inexplicable reason, they wanted to kill a high-ranking Saudi, Iran could easily pick off half a dozen royals in the casinos and brothels of Monte Carlo and other glitzy resorts. Or so says Bangash. Again, only a nincompoop could find this preposterous alleged plot the least bit plausible. Here's Zafar Bangash speaking with Canadian radio host Brandon Stone.
And the allegation further was that Iran wanted to have the Saudi ambassador Adel al-Jubeir assassinated in Washington, D.C. Now, first of all, if Iran really wanted to do anything against Saudi Arabia, why would it want to pick up a very minor figure in the Saudi establishment like their ambassador to Washington when he is not even a member of the royal family? I mean, in the Saudi hierarchy, Adel al-Jubeir is pretty low. He's pretty insignificant. It's just like saying that somebody wants to knock an elephant and they go and kill the mouse that's clinging to its tail. I mean, it's bizarre. I mean,
it seems that Iran has little or nothing to gain from this, but it's very dangerous if they had come up with such a plot. I mean, if they were actually to conduct some kind of attack on U.S. soil, it would be national suicide.
Absolutely, exactly. I mean, what precisely would they gain by doing something like that? That's the question that nobody has been able to answer. In fact, Michael Rubin, who is a senior analyst at the American Enterprise Institute, and that's incidentally an organization or a think tank that is very close to the Israeli government, even he has rubbished this allegation to say that it is so bizarre that it makes absolutely no sense. Now, let me point out, if let's say the Iranians wanted to do something to the Saudis, an Iranian member of parliament a few days ago had issued a statement to say that if Iran wanted to occupy Saudi Arabia, it wouldn't take them more than a few days. I mean, why would they want to kill somebody like al-Jubeir? But let's say the Iranians wanted to kill somebody in the Saudi hierarchy. I think they can find a lot more enticing targets among the Saudi royal family, people like Bandar bin Sultan or Walid bin Talal. These people frequent gambling casinos and nightclubs and brothels all over the world. I mean, they go to Southeast Asia, to Thailand and, places like that. They would be very easy targets to pick up. Why would Iran want to, undertake a very dangerous and risky operation in the U.S. and then using Mexican drug cartels? I mean, it is just outlandishly ridiculous. And,
yes.
And I think, the fact that many American commentators themselves have ridiculed these allegations goes to show that obviously the American administration is becoming desperate. They want to divert their people's attention. Obviously, a lot of things are going on in the U.S. with respect to this Occupy Wall Street movement, that much as they may want to dismiss it or try to downplay it, it's not going away anywhere. And so they want to divert attention from that. Michelle Nofel, who is the foreign editor of Lebanon's Al-Mustaqbal newspaper, he said that he has doubts about the timing of the charges if the United States had been aware of the plot for months. I mean, obviously, we knew that Obama was aware of it, he said, and then he asks, why now? Obama was told in June. So why do you bring this matter up now in October when Obama was aware of it? So there are a number of very serious questions being raised about the allegations being made against Iran. And, it was interesting that Obama, after these revelations were made, he called the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C., and he said that the U.S. believes that this plot is a flagrant violation of U.S. and international law. Now, it is so laughable because 3 days later, the same U.S. government under Obama's administration which has been carrying out drone attacks in Pakistan. On October the 14th, four other civilians were killed by a drone attack in Pakistan's tribal area, which is a clear violation of international law as well as Pakistan's sovereignty.
Well, they seem to be happy to violate U.S. domestic law, too, because you had the momentous day when Obama approved a strike against a U.S. citizen.
So. Oh, absolutely. Anwar al-Awlaki, yes. He was born in the U.S., and he was in his sort of ancestral home in Yemen. And on September the 30th, a missile was fired from a U.S. drone, killing not only Anwar al-Awlaki, but another U.S.-born citizen, Samir Khan. He was also killed. He was not even on a terror list or anything. He just happened to be in the area. And here is the U.S. government openly killing its own citizens. That means in violation of U.S. law as well as international law, that you know, it can go around doing all these terrible things, all these terrorist acts against its own citizens as well as the citizens of other countries, and yet Obama has the gall to turn around and make an allegation against Iran when there is absolutely no proof. Like, you know, one of the most bizarre things in the story about the Arbab Siyar episode was that the U.S. alleged that he had wire transferred $100,000 from a bank in Iran to his bank account in the U.S. Now, anybody who is even, you know, superficially familiar with banking arrangements, because Iran is under sanctions, no Iranian bank is allowed to carry out transactions in U.S. dollars. So if, let's say, an Iranian businessman or anybody wanted to send money to me, it's impossible to do so because the International Bank of Transactions will not process that transaction because of the U.S. sanctions.
Zafar Bangesh, speaking with host Brandon Stone of the show Unusual Sources in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Bangesh has shown several more reasons not to believe the assassination story, among them the fact that the $100,000 wire transfer from Tehran to Texas simply could not have been made. 45 years ago, Tom Lehrer made some observations about U.S. military interventions anywhere and everywhere. Maybe the technology has changed a bit since 1965. Maybe now we send fewer troops and drop more bombs. But the principles and the results are pretty similar. Here's Tom Lehrer.
What with President Johnson practicing escalatio on the Vietnamese, and then the Dominican crisis on top of that, it has been a nervous year, and people have begun to feel like a Christian Scientist with appendicitis. Fortunately, in times of crisis like this, America always has its number one instrument of diplomacy to fall back on. Here's a song about it. Someone makes a move of which we don't approve. Who is it that always intervenes? UN and OAS, they have their place, I guess. But first, send the Marines. We'll send them all we've got. John Wayne and Randolph Scott. Remember those exciting fighting scenes. To the shores of Tripoli, but not to Mississippi. What do? We send the Marines. For might makes right. Until they've seen the light, they've got to be protected, all their rights respected, till somebody we like can be elected. Members of the Corps all hate the thought of war. They'd rather kill them off by peaceful means. Stop calling it aggression. Ooh, we hate that expression. We only want the world to know that we support the status quo. They love us everywhere we go. So when in doubt, send the Marines.
Now, from Iran, back to the shores of Tripoli and a nice article in Counterpunch by Anthony DiMaggio, slightly condensed and edited for radio by yours truly. What the establishment isn't telling you about Libya. Washington erupted in self-congratulation over Muammar Gaddafi's death. Our sycophantic media, which never saw a foreign intervention it didn't like, added further praise. They repeat the propaganda about the United States' vital role in ending world tyranny and promoting freedom and democracy ad nauseam. Reuters hailed Gaddafi's death as a warning to authoritarian leaders across the Middle East that iron-fisted rule inevitably comes to an end. The Los Angeles Times editors reminded the Obama administration of the need to play a constructive role in post-Gaddafi Libya. Quote, "The rebels could not have succeeded without months of relentless NATO airstrikes. But a longer-term challenge is to establish a democratic and pluralistic society. The United States and its allies can lend expertise to the designers of a new Libyan democracy." Unquote. Buried within the LA Times editorial was the admission that, quote, "No one seemed able to explain why Libya was more appropriate for intervention than many other nations ruled by autocrats." Unquote. This question is exactly what observers should be asking themselves when they hear politicians celebrating the U.S. selflessness and altruism in Libya. The blatant hypocrisy of democratic intervention in Libya, coupled with U.S. support for brutal dictatorships throughout the rest of the world, is seldom discussed. If it were, pundits would have to acknowledge the United States' long-standing support for the repressive Saudi regime, which continues to escalate its human rights atrocities. Consider the 2011 Human Rights Watch report on Saudi Arabia. The report highlights a pattern of Saudi abuses that are barbaric. Torture is routinely used to extract confessions, while authorities systematically refuse to inform criminal suspects of the charges leveled against them. It is common practice in Saudi Arabia to arrest citizens for criticizing prominent Sunni clerics. Women are treated as legal minors under the guardian system, which denies them basic rights taken for granted in Western countries. Immigrant workers, who make up half the country's workforce, are regularly repressed. Human Rights Watch describes their, quote, "slavery-like conditions," unquote, seen most clearly in the, quote, "withholding of wages and forcing of many migrants to work against their will," unquote. Saudi Arabia is also a world leader in beheadings. It executed nearly 60 people, that's 60, in the first 10 months of 2011 alone, for a variety of unforgivable offenses, such as being homosexual. Or consider Bahrain. The U.S. gave Saudi Arabia carte blanche to attack Bahraini Shiite protesters. Working closely with Bahrain's Sunni government, the Saudi-Bahraini repression included a ban on the political opposition party, systematic detainment, beatings, and rape of female minors and others, censorship of the country's main opposition paper, and even the prosecution of dozens of the country's top medical professionals, who were charged with the crime of providing medical treatment to protesters who were injured by the Saudi government forces. Such disgusting behavior is seen as absolutely vital by the U.S., since Bahrain is of vital strategic importance. The country hosts the U.S. Fifth Fleet and is geographically situated next to majority Shiite areas in Saudi Arabia, which hold the lion's share of Saudi oil. If these areas were to fall under independent Shiite control, it would pose a major threat to American dominance of the region's oil reserves. An independent Shiite government in Saudi Arabia would likely move towards strengthening relations with Shiite-majority countries such as Iran and Iraq, which are both independent of U.S. control. This nightmare scenario would be, and is, vehemently opposed by the U.S. Savage repression by U.S. allies is conveniently ignored by editorials that say the U.S. is in the Middle East simply to promote liberty and democracy. The long U.S. history of admitting neocolonial policy concerns is also completely ignored. Simply put, policy has long been driven by concern with dominating Middle Eastern oil supplies by force. We consistently support repressive U.S.-friendly regimes in regions, such as North Africa, that border the Middle East. Libya was destabilized by its civil war. Instability within enemy countries is often cited as justification for U.S. intervention. For example, the Reagan administration spoke of unstable governments and weak political institutions within geographic areas of strategic importance, spoke of them as posing, quote, threats to U.S. national security, unquote. None of the above points is addressed in any serious or consistent way in the U.S. media. We should not let this perverted discussion obscure our understanding of what was really at stake in the Libyan conflict. Strategically speaking, U.S. interests in Libya are no different than those throughout the Middle East. The same contempt for democracy drives U.S. foreign policy, regardless of location. So ends Anthony DiMaggio's October 24 article, What the Establishment Isn't Telling You About Libya.
When someone makes a move of which we don't approve, who is it that always intervenes? UN and OAS, they have their place, I guess. But first, send the Marines!
Thanks for listening to New World Notes on Iran, Libya, and the Art of Nincompoopism. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. And Connecticut has been darker than usual during our recent week-long power failure. There's a free archive of past shows at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illigitimai non carborundum and stay warm. Ciao.